Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ambition for What? By Deborah L. Rohde. Narrated by Pam Ward. Chapter 1. Introduction. When I was 27, in my first year as a law professor at Stanford, my father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and given 3 months to live. He was 61. His death was agonizing to watch, in part because he was assessing his aspirations and accomplishments and was not all that happy with what he saw. It reminded me of one of the world's most enduring novels about ambition, which I had read in college, Leo Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Ilyich. Tolstoy was an ambitious man. The son of an aristocratic family, he spent his early years as an indifferent student and dissolute soldier, but then married, settled on his family estate, and became one of the world's great novelists. Although he achieved considerable fame and fortune, in midlife he sank into a serious depression and spiritual crisis. As he later explained in The Confession, the question, which in my 50th year had brought me very close to suicide, was the simplest of all questions. What result will there be from what I am doing now and may do tomorrow? Otherwise expressed, it may run, why should I live? Is there any meaning in my life which can overcome the inevitable death awaiting me? In attempting to answer that question, Tolstoy came to realize that the ambitions for recognition, wealth, and power that had ruled his life had failed to provide ultimate meaning. Well, he recalls thinking, what if he should become richer or more famous than all the writers in the world? Well, and what then? I could find no reply. Although Tolstoy was, in fact, one of the most famous authors of his time, those questions continued to haunt him and framed one of his greatest works, The Death of Ivan Ilyich. Its main character is a magistrate who never quite managed to earn a salary that would support his lifestyle and whose main passion was playing whist. When struck with a fatal illness, he tried to defend the values by which he had lived his life and suddenly felt all the feebleness of what he was defending. And there was nothing to defend. This realization increased his sufferings, multiplied them tenfold. After watching my father struggle with some final moments not unlike those of Ilyich, I suddenly realized that this could happen to me too. I could die of cancer tomorrow, and what would I have accomplished? Even the most influential legal scholarship generally has only a fleeting shelf life, and few academics can really know how much difference they have made in the lives of their students or institutions. I shared my anxiety with my husband, an environmental public interest lawyer. I am not writing for the ages here, I pointed out. I am not Hegel. He responded, from the standpoint of geologic time, who is Hegel? The questions that challenged Tolstoy and that tormented Ilyich and my younger self are part of what drives this book. Ambition is an exceptionally ambitious topic. It has inspired some of the world's greatest philosophy, literature, and religious thought, as well as a substantial body of social science research. Ambition is also, for me and for most of those I know, a deeply personal issue. I have struggled with the questions that inspire this book and watched family, friends, colleagues, and students do the same. Everyone must find their own answers, but my hope is that the chapters to follow will prompt some readers to think more deeply about the questions. I reread The Death of Ivan Ilyich when I was in my 50s, after doctors discovered potentially malignant cysts in my pancreas. Given my family history, these cysts were what one specialist described as ticking time bombs. But removing them would require what another doctor referred to as not walk-in-the-park surgery, with significant risks of serious complications. Many people live long lives despite such cysts, and I decided to hope that I am one of them. Again, during the completion of this book, as the coronavirus was taking its toll on my demographic, I showed symptoms of bladder cancer. As cancers go, it is not one of the good kinds, but it is rarely fatal if caught in time. It isn't, always. I had months of misery waiting for test results that eventually returned me to the happy state of, at least I don't have cancer as far as I know. Still, the looming possibility of mortality has often encouraged me to revisit priorities and to think about what I would like said at my memorial service. Well, there is still time to make some changes. My wish is for something along the lines expressed by Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, a hero of the American Civil Rights Movement, for whom I clerked in the late 1970s. When he retired from the court and was asked how he wanted to be remembered, Marshall responded simply, "He did what he could with what he had." I hope someone someday says that about me. And my hope is that some readers of this book will think more deeply about what they want to be said about them. Definitions. Ambition is a dominant force in most civilizations, driving their greatest achievements and most horrific abuses. Our deep-seated desire for achievement and acclaim has helped bring us art, airplanes, and antibiotics, as well as wars, genocide, and despotism. This mixed record has left us ambivalent about ambition. We see too little as a failing, and too much as a sin. We dismiss those who lack it and despise those who misuse it. But this conventional way of framing the issue as too much or too little ambition misses the point. The central questions should be ambition for what and at what price. To address those questions, we need a clear understanding about what exactly we mean by the concept. Dictionary definitions of ambition generally characterize it as a strong desire for rank, fame, or power, or for anything considered advantageous, honoring, or creditable, including wealth and success. This definition captures a duality that runs throughout this book. A central premise is that a desire for external markers of success, such as money, recognition, or power, accounts for many of the negative consequences associated with ambition, while a desire for what is honorable accounts for many of the benefits. In essence, the value of ambition depends on what we are ambitious for. Some psychologists and philosophers draw a distinction between ambition and a related concept, a drive for achievement. In their view, achievement generally implies an exercise of skill to accomplish something meaningful. Ambition, by contrast, involves a desire for success, regardless of whether it is based on superior performance. Although many ambitious individuals have a strong desire for achievement, their goals focus more on outcomes than ability. The achievement-driven scientist wants to find a cure for cancer. The ambitious scientist wants also to be recognized as the one who found it. But conventional usage of the term ambition does not draw that distinction, nor does differentiating between success and achievement resolve the question that should be central to evaluating ambition: how well it serves the self and others. Moreover, for some individuals, achievement and success are intertwined. These people measure their achievements in terms of societal definitions of success, or adopt a view of success that responds to their own personal priorities. And both achievement and success are ultimately subjective concepts. What counts depends on an individual's own identity, values, and circumstances. In my own profession, the goals worth pursuing look very different to a Wall Street attorney, a public defender, and a legal academic. Accordingly, this book will use ambition as an umbrella term, encompassing both success and achievement. The discussion will then drill down on what forms of ambition best serve individual and societal interests. Context. Ambition is a timeless concept, as the book's later references to biblical and classical philosophical views make clear. People have always been ambitious in fulfilling certain material and psychological needs, such as those involving money, status, and power. But rising standards of living and technological innovations have dramatically widened the scale, scope, and consequences of ambition in ways we are only beginning to acknowledge. For much of recorded history, for much of humanity, ambitions were highly circumscribed. For hunters and gatherers, subsistence farmers, serfs, and slaves, the main project was survival. In contemporary affluent societies, technology has given ambition a wider, sometimes global, scope. It has enabled comparisons between more people in more ways than ever before possible. We now know with considerable precision not just who is the richest person in our community or country, but also who is the richest in our world. Power grabs by international leaders can push us to the brink of nuclear annihilation. We can measure status and fame in new ways, likes on Instagram, followers on Twitter. This ability to assess our own achievements against the entire social media universe has increased the stakes in unhealthy ways that are charted throughout the subsequent chapters. All of these developments have made a deeper understanding of ambition more urgent. Themes. The book proceeds in three parts. Part one explores the primary targets of ambition in American culture: recognition or status, money, and power. These goals are, of course, interrelated. Recognition often brings money and power, just as power confers recognition, and recognition confers power. And part of what makes money so valuable is its ability to generate power and status. But to understand the particular role that these objectives play in shaping ambition, it makes sense to focus on them separately. What ties them all together, however, is the theme suggested by William Thackeray's famous 19th-century novel of ambition, Vanity Fair. Too many of us are striving for what is not worth the having. Chapter 2 begins with recognition, or what social scientists sometimes refer to as status. The desire for approval and admiration is common to all cultures, but it assumes distinctive forms and force in contemporary American society. This drive underpins our national obsession with rankings for everything from America's sexiest man alive to its champion hot dog eater. Yet while recognition offers an effective spur for performance, it can also wreak havoc when self-promotion becomes the dominant goal. The single-minded pursuit of status that often propels people into leadership positions can sabotage their effectiveness once they arrive. Leaders preoccupied with gaining recognition for their own achievement may shortchange organizational concerns on which success ultimately depends. Chapter 3 focuses on the pursuit of money and the pleasures, power, and recognition that it confers. Measured by individual consumption, the United States is the most materialist society in the world, and American youth view becoming well off financially as a dominant goal in life. For many individuals, self-worth is linked to net worth and is a critical way of keeping score and exercising control. Yet research consistently finds that wealth has far less to do with life satisfaction than we commonly assume. Once basic needs are met, the pleasures from new purchases are often transitory and quickly displaced by further demands. Individuals whose ambitions focus on materialistic gain are more susceptible to anxiety and depression and report lower life satisfaction than those motivated by other values, such as fostering relationships and contributing to larger social ends. Chapter 4 focuses on power as an object of ambition, whether for its own sake or for the status it confers. As with other forms of ambition, this desire can drive high performance. But if unchecked by other values, the craving for power is partly responsible for some of mankind's greatest atrocities. Too many leaders use power primarily to enhance their own dominance and control, rather than to advance collective goals. Yet even from a self-interested perspective, self-serving uses of power are often counterproductive. They erode the trust and support that is necessary to sustain influence over the long term. In well-functioning democracies and workplaces, ambition for power is productive only if its ultimate objectives transcend the self. Part 2 shifts focus from the objects of ambition to the influences on its development and pursuit. While earlier chapters emphasized the adverse effects of excessive ambitions, chapters 5 and 6 consider the adverse consequences when ambitions are skewed or blocked by identity-related characteristics. Chapter 5 explores gender, how men and women differ in their aspirations and their opportunities to realize them. Although women on average report somewhat different priorities than men, these differences do not begin to explain the substantial gender gaps in positions of greatest power, status, and rewards. Unconscious bias, sexual harassment, lack of support and mentoring, and inflexible workplace structures undermine women's ambitions. This is problematic not only for individuals, but also for society. Women rank as well or better than men on almost all leadership competencies, and workplaces need to take advantage of their entire talent pool. An effective democracy also needs political leaders who are broadly representative of the people they govern. We remain a considerable distance from these goals, and the chapter identifies strategies for individuals and institutions to bring us closer. Chapter 6 looks at how youth develop ambition and how demographic factors such as class, race, ethnicity, and national origin construct and constrain achievement. Other nations do much better than the United States in enabling the American dream of being able to succeed whatever one's family background. The chapter begins by exploring what youth are ambitious for and their frequent lack of realistic strategies for pursuing their dreams. Many underestimate the educational credentials necessary to achieve their ambitions or the barriers that they will encounter in realizing their goals. Much of the problem has to do with structural inequality and biases across class, race, ethnicity, and national origin. About 70% of individuals from families in the bottom two-fifths of the income distribution never make it to the middle, and only 7-8% make it to the top. The percentages are even lower for people of color, and even those born in relatively affluent families have a greater likelihood of downward mobility than their white counterparts. The only exception to this pattern is first-generation children of immigrants, who generally surpass their parents' socioeconomic status through a combination of exceptional ambition and hard work. Part of the reason for the overall class, racial, and economic disparities are educational inequality and implicit bias in the workplace and criminal justice system. The chapter concludes with strategies for families, educators, employers, and policymakers to help more American youth translate their ambitions into achievement. Part 3 focuses on how to channel ambitions in a more constructive direction. Chapter 7 looks at what families, schools, and colleges can do. Parents' vicarious ambitions are a mixed blessing. Although their desire to see their children succeed is understandable, and their sacrifices to that end are often admirable, it matters how they define success and what pressures they exert. Children from affluent, well-educated and well-meaning families experience the highest rate of mental health difficulties of all adolescents. Many are pushed into schools, activities, and career paths that have more to do with the parents' ambition than their own. Some are shielded from the challenges and disappointments that build resilience and aid personal growth. Schools, for their part, have sometimes compounded pressures through an excessive focus on grades and test performance, and have failed to adequately deal with the widespread cheating that often results. The arms race for college admission and the outsized role that prestige and rankings play in students' decisions have further exacerbated unhealthy stress and misfocused priorities. The chapter also explores ways that parents, schools, teachers, employers, and policymakers can help channel young people's ambitions in more constructive directions. Youth can learn strategies for resilience and receive greater encouragement to pursue service learning and to focus on goals that will maximize meaning, purpose, and lifelong satisfaction. Chapter 8 concludes the book by focusing on its most fundamental questions. Ambition for what? And at what cost? Discussion begins with various ways to describe the good life, and what contemporary research tells us about the sources of sustained well-being and fulfillment. One central conclusion is that even from a purely self-interested perspective, individuals would do well to strive for some goals that transcend the self. Pursuing objectives that have intrinsic value, such as building relationships and contributing to society, generally brings deeper fulfillment than chasing extrinsic rewards, such as wealth, power, and fame. Misfocused ambition imposes enormous costs. Individuals pay a price in psychological health, impaired relationships, and deathbed regrets. And society suffers when self-advancement crowds out efforts for the common good. Honestly confronting our ambitions is not always a pleasant prospect. For me, the process has unearthed some painful truths, but the costs of avoidance are far greater. My hope is that the chapters to follow will prompt readers to reconsider where their ambitions are leading and whether that destination reflects their deepest needs for meaning and fulfillment. Part 1. Objects of Ambition. Chapter 2. Recognition. Social recognition has often been viewed as the dominant human ambition, with other goals, such as wealth or power, serving as means to that end. In underscoring the importance of admiration and approval, the 18th century philosopher David Hume noted that our deepest sources of pride, such as virtue, beauty, and riches, have little influence when not seconded by the opinions and sentiments of others. Contemporary social scientists agree, although they typically use the term status to convey the respect, admiration, and deference that are fundamental motives for human behavior. Status is a universal need, but the forms it takes for individuals depend on context. People may have high status in one setting, such as the workplace, but not in another, such as a circle of friends or family. Some crave respect from peers. Others want the applause of nameless multitudes. I use the term recognition rather than status here, because it is more consistent with how people outside academia generally understand and describe their ambition. In the discussion that follows, recognition serves as an umbrella concept that encompasses all the various forms of status, respect, fame, honor, and approval that drive human behavior. As is true for other forms of ambition, the pursuit of recognition can have positive or negative consequences for the self and others, depending on the form it takes. As a general matter, the quest for honor and respect is likely to push individuals in more productive directions than the lust for fame. The importance of recognition, the historical backdrop. Although the desire for recognition is common to all eras and societies, researchers generally credit ancient Rome as the first to actively foster a craving for fame. Thought leaders such as Cicero diligently accumulated honors, and Emperor Augustus put his face on a coin. The early Christian church sought to substitute the glorification of God for the glorification of self, but its successes were partial and relatively short-lived. By the 18th century, leading thinkers, including not only David Hume but also Adam Smith, recognized the importance of esteem and admiration. In Smith's view, the wish to be noticed with sympathy and approval accounted for half the labors of human life. Smith thought this was a positive force, as long as the admiration was for qualities and talents which are the natural and proper objects of esteem and admiration. A key mission of education was, therefore, to direct vanity to proper objects. There was, Smith believed, an important difference between love of praise and love of praiseworthiness. The latter reflected the wish to be the kind of person who is entitled to the approval of a competent and impartial spectator. That love of praiseworthiness was, for Smith, the only truly moral and socially desirable form of ambition. His distinction captures the dual nature of ambition that recurs throughout this book. Poets as well as philosophers recognize the importance and duality of recognition, which Alexander Pope labeled the instinct of all great souls. But, as Pope also emphasized, it mattered what recognition was for. People should wish that the Creator would grant an honest fame, or grant me none. In the United States, this desire for esteem was further reinforced by the Puritan ethic, which interpreted worldly success as a sign of God's favor. Alexis de Tocqueville identified a yearning desire to rise as part of the American ethos, and many commentators saw it as a positive force. William James thought that the deepest human need was the craving to be appreciated. The societal benefits that follow from this ambition are apparent in the founding of the American Republic. Historians have chronicled how the desire for fame and secular immortality drove the political behavior of George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. Douglas Adair notes that the greatest and the most effective leaders of 1787, no angels they, passionately selfish and self-interested men, were giants in part because the revolution had led them to redefine their notions of interest and had given them, through the concept of fame, a personal stake in creating a national system dedicated to liberty, to justice, and to the general welfare. The founders themselves emphasized the importance of recognition. John Adams argued that it was not just benevolence, but also the desire for reputation that made us good members of society. In his view, society's most effective rewards and punishments were the esteem and admiration, or the neglect and contempt, of others. Alexander Hamilton similarly believed that love of fame was the ruling passion of the noblest minds. The surest path to recognition varied over time. Clergy were particularly esteemed in the 1700s, politicians in the 1800s, scientists and novelists in the 1900s, and entertainers and professional athletes in the 2000s. Technology has played a role in shifting the gateways to fame. The growth of the film, television, and recording industries created the mass audiences that give rise to a celebrity culture. And social media platforms have further contributed to the obsessive pursuit of fame by giving people more and better options to reproduce themselves on a wider scale. Historian William Casey King points out that in contemporary American society...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?